Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, we have a higher education story about college and university presidents in the United States. Then, Ana Mateo brings us this week's episode of Words and Their Stories. Stay tuned for a conversation about the phrase sink or swim. After that, you'll hear the next part in our series on America's presidents from Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this science story from Dan Novak.
Since the middle of the 20th century, humans have had a very strong effect on planet Earth. These effects have included climate change, species loss, and pollution. Humanity's impact has been so strong that scientists say a new geological epoch began then. The scientists call it the Anthropocene Epoch. The word comes from the Greek terms for human and new. This epoch started sometime between 1950 and 1954, the scientists say. There is evidence worldwide of the harmful impact on the Earth's health of burning fossil fuels, dropping nuclear weapons, and releasing fertilizers and plastics on land and in water. It's quite clear that the scale of change has intensified unbelievably, and that has to be human impact, said University of Leicester geologist Colin Waters. He led the Anthropocene Working Group. The scientists say the power of humans is comparable with the meteorite that crashed into Earth 66 million years ago. The meteorite killed off the dinosaurs and started the Cenozoic era, or what is known as the Age of Mammals. While that meteorite started a whole new era, the working group is proposing that humans only started a new epoch. An epoch is a much smaller geological time period. The scientists are proposing a small but deep lake outside of Toronto, Canada, to place a historic marker. The lake is called Crawford Lake. The group aims to decide on an exact start date of the Anthropocene by measuring plutonium levels at the bottom of Crawford Lake. There are clear signs in Crawford Lake showing that, starting in 1950, the effects of humans overwhelm the Earth system, said Francine McCarthy. She is part of the working group who specializes in that site as an Earth Sciences professor at Brock University in Canada. The Anthropocene epoch shows the power and hubris of humankind, several scientists said. Hubris is a great or foolish amount of confidence. Geologists measure time in eons, eras, periods, epochs, and ages, with eons being the longest. The scientific working group is proposing that the Anthropocene epoch followed the Holocene epoch. Holocene started about 11,700 years ago, at the end of an ice age. The proposal still needs to be approved by three different groups of geologists. It could be signed at a major conference next year. Naomi Oreskes is a science historian with Harvard University and a working group member. She said if there is no change to harmful human activities, we are headed for tragedy. I'm Dan Novak.
Three women started new terms as presidents at Ivy League universities in July. Their appointments mean that six of the eight highly selective schools are led by a female president. Sion Bylock is now the first female president at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Neymat Shafiq, who was born in Egypt, is the first female president at Columbia University in New York City. And Claudine Gay is the first Black person and the second woman to lead Harvard University. They joined Christina Paxson at Brown University in Rhode Island, Martha Pollack at Cornell University in New York, and Elizabeth McGill at the University of Pennsylvania. The two Ivies with male presidents are Princeton University in New Jersey and Yale University in Connecticut. While women lead six out of eight Ivy League schools, the story is far different at other American colleges and universities. Only about 32% of college or university presidents are women. That number comes from the American Council on Education, ACE. The organization says, in its 2023 report, that the data is important because of the makeup of college students in the United States. Today, there are more women in colleges, about 60% of all students, and more minorities. But about 70% of college presidents are white, and 46% are white men. Only 10% are women of color, and most college presidents are about 60 years old. Hiro Okahana led the research team for ACE's report. He called the news of the three new Ivy League presidents a very exciting thing to see, but he also called it an anomaly. An anomaly is a piece of information different from the expected result in a study. Choosing women and minorities, he said, sends a good message to colleges and universities, but he did have one concern.
It's important that they are bringing into a place where they are set up to, for success and being able to thrive as leaders. We'll be continue to see how their presidency will shape up to be and lead these institutions toward the future.
ACE's study showed that some women who became university presidents felt they did not get enough information about the university's health before they took the job.
Felicia Commodore teaches higher education at Old Dominion University in Virginia. She wrote about the Ivy League presidents for The Conversation. Commodore suggests the news is important, but it would be a bigger story if large public universities in the U.S. had more female or Black presidents. Of note, large universities such as Ohio State, Penn State, and Texas A&M recently appointed female presidents. Carolyn Pippin is a college advisor for Ivy Wives, a company that helps students prepare for college. She said students have so many things to consider: study programs, housing, and post-graduation. They don't often think about the president. She gave Harvard as an example.
I don't think there are any students that are worried that Harvard is going to be anything other than a fantastic experience. And certainly going to set them up for success.
Some students, though, see women taking leadership positions at colleges as wonderful. That is what Ava Ayala said. She will start her second year at Colorado State University this autumn. I think that having more women in these roles really opens up pathways to allow other people, maybe of different race or gender, to step into those roles next. Colorado State appointed a female president in 2023.
Okahana, the research leader, said colleges and universities should work to widen their search for future presidents. If they are looking for leaders who better reflect their student population, they should consider business leaders, medical experts, and others. We know there are many different pathways to rise up to the college presidency, he said. Sometimes that can include people who were international students. Okahana is from Japan, and he went to college at a large university in California. He said, seeing and talking with the school's president made him think about working in higher education. And his report showed nearly 10% of American college presidents were not born in the U.S. So he said, there are some readers and listeners of this piece who might lead an institution in the United States one day. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We give examples, notes on usage, and sometimes we use them in short stories. Today we talk about a great activity to keep healthy and cool. In hot weather, there is nothing better than swimming in cool water. Swimming is a great way to beat the heat and get exercise. But swimming is not only for fun. Knowing how to swim can save your life. If you do not know how to swim, you could sink in the water. And it can happen fast. So today we talk about the idiom, to sink or swim. To sink or swim means you either quickly succeed at something or quickly fail. To sink or swim suggests that you will either succeed or fail based on your own skills. Others may have taught you or helped you to prepare for something, but the final responsibility is yours. So we use this idiom to describe a high-pressure situation where your success or survival depends on your ability to perform. We sometimes pair the idiom sink or swim with the expression to be thrown into the deep end, as in the deep part of a pool. A parent, teacher, or coach could throw a child into the deep end to see if the child will sink or swim, although it is not likely. Usually, it means to put someone in a situation to see how they do. For example, let's say you have been preparing for an English test for many weeks. If you pass it, you may be able to get a better position at your job. You had a great teacher who helped you, but on test day, it's sink or swim. Success is up to you. Sink or swim can also describe a situation where you must succeed quickly or you will fail fully. There is no middle ground. It is a win or lose situation. In these situations, we can also say, it's now or never. This means the time to prove yourself is now. You will not have another chance. All your preparation has come to this moment, whatever that moment is. You need to rise to the occasion. Sink or swim situations can also be called make or break events. They can either make you better or they can break you. If the situation is very serious and the risks are very great, you can also say do or die. You either take action or you will definitely fail. Luckily, learning English is not a do-or-die situation, and VOA Learning English will be here to help you grow your English skills so you can swim instead of sink in the test pool. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Broadcast. Thanks for joining us today. You just heard Words and Their Stories with Ana Mateo. She discussed the phrase sink or swim. Ana, thanks for being here. Can you tell us how you picked that idiom?
Sure, absolutely. Dan, with Words and Their Stories, I hear idioms used around me all the time, from my family, my friends, colleagues, so it is not difficult to find a topic. And to sink or swim was one that I heard. And also, it is summertime here in Washington, D.C., and I swim every morning.
Ana, have you been swimming for a long time? What's your swimming session like when you go out in the water?
Sure. I am a morning swimmer. I like to get my exercise done early. So by 7 a.m., I have my coffee and I am in the water, ready to sink or swim. And Dan, I jump off the deep end. I jump in the deep end of our pool and I don't really do laps. Laps are when you swim back and forth and back and forth. I go into the deep end and I don't sink. I swim. I tread water. I swim in place for probably an hour and get my exercise that way.
Ana, sink or swim is an expression we use to show we are facing an important moment. What is another word combination like this, and when would you use it?
So we use it usually in a test, a challenge, a high-pressure situation. There are consequences. There are risks, perhaps. And really, the outcome is in your hands, nobody else's. And that is why we say it's a challenge. Are you going to sink or are you going to swim? Succeed or fail? Do or die? Make or break? Now or never?
Ana, this is so interesting. However, it's now time to end this part of the broadcast, or we will run out of time. I guess this is a now or never situation. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Ana.
You're welcome, Dan. Anytime.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about James Garfield. He was the 20th president of the United States. Garfield is not one of the best-known presidents. He served only 100 days before he was shot. 11 weeks later, he died from his wounds. But even during Garfield's short time in office, historians say his presidency had problems. Like the president before him, Rutherford B. Hayes, Garfield was from the state of Ohio. Garfield's father died when he was very young. The future president was raised largely by his mother, two older sisters, and a brother. Among all the presidents, Garfield probably was the most poor in his early years. Growing up, he worked as a farmer, a sailor, a carpenter, a teacher, and a janitor. Finally, he earned a position as a student at Williams College in Western Massachusetts. Garfield loved learning. He eventually taught at a school called the Eclectic Institute. Later, he became its president. Garfield married one of his students at the Eclectic Institute, Lucretia Rudolph. She became a teacher, too. The future president and his wife went on to have 7 children. 4 sons and a daughter survived to adulthood. In time, Garfield moved out of education and into law and politics. He was an anti-slavery activist who did not think the Southern states had a right to withdraw from the Union. When the Civil War came, Garfield welcomed it. During the war, Garfield served in the military as an officer. He won awards for his bravery. While still a young man, he was appointed to the position of Major General. His image as a war hero was so great that Garfield did not have to campaign for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was elected on his name alone. Garfield's way of thinking changed while he was in Congress. He began as one of the most extreme radical Republicans. He wanted to punish former Confederate officers severely. But in time, Garfield softened his positions. He learned to compromise with other groups in order to achieve results for his state. But he did not always represent the interests of workers or farmers in Ohio. Garfield supported business interests that wanted to limit the country's money supply. He opposed labor unions and cooperative farm programs, called the Grange. Garfield also became linked to a corruption case. He accepted stock shares in a company that was building a railroad across the country. In exchange, Garfield and other top officials eased government rules so businessmen could earn higher profits for their work. Although Garfield's political career sometimes drew criticism, he continued to rise in government. When Garfield became president in March 1881, he did not have what Americans call a mandate, the approval of a large part of the population. Instead, he needed to make compromises with lawmakers to help win their support. As a result, the first weeks of his presidency were a political struggle to appoint members to his cabinet of advisors. Garfield also clashed with a powerful senator from New York State. The senator wanted to continue the tradition of permitting senators to choose who got government jobs in their states. But President Garfield wanted to put someone who shared his own beliefs in some of the top positions in New York. Finally, the senator resigned in protest. But the issue set the tone for Garfield's short time in office. Elected officials battled each other for advantages and financial gain. Officials in Garfield's party were accused of corruption and wrongdoing. And before Garfield could really suggest any ideas for government reform, he was shot by someone seeking a government job in exchange for his political support. On July 2, 1881, fewer than 4 months after he took office, Garfield was leaving for a short trip with two of his sons. They were going to take a train to Williams, the college Garfield had attended and loved. The president was supposed to give a speech there. But as he walked through the train station, a man with a gun stepped behind Garfield and shot the president twice. One bullet touched Garfield's arm. The other went into his lower back. Garfield did not die immediately. Instead, he was taken back to the White House, where doctors tried to remove the bullet. One of the men who tried was Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. Bell tried to find the bullet by using a device like a metal detector that he had invented. But the springs on Garfield's bed interfered. Neither Bell nor the doctors were able to remove the bullet. And, some historians say, their efforts may have made the situation worse. Garfield suffered for more than 2 months. At one point, he seemed to be recovering. But on September 19th, he finally died. He was 49 years old. As for the gunman, he was captured shortly after the shooting. His name was Charles Guiteau. Guiteau was a lawyer with little money, but many mental problems. During the election of 1880, he had first supported the candidacy of former President Ulysses S. Grant. When Garfield won the Republican nomination instead, Guiteau supported him. Guiteau did not have an official role in the election campaign, and Garfield did not know him. But over time, Guiteau came to believe that he was responsible for Garfield winning the presidency. As a result, Guiteau thought Garfield owed him a government job. Guiteau wrote the president several letters requesting positions as a diplomat in Europe. When Garfield did not write back, Guiteau grew angry. He believed Garfield was ruining the Republican Party and destroying the country. For weeks, Guiteau followed the president and plotted to kill him. When he succeeded in shooting Garfield, Guiteau believed he had performed a great service. At his trial, a jury decided that Guiteau was sane. In other words, he was not too mentally unbalanced to be responsible for his crime. Almost a year after he shot the president, Guiteau himself was hanged. Thus, the most dramatic event in James Garfield's presidency came to an end. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedell.